It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. Like many other older industrial cities, the Pittsburgh region has its share of blight. According to the most recent data from the 2010 census, there are more than 50,000 vacant houses in Allegheny County. For more than a century, federal, state, and city governments have tried to address the issue. As 90.5 WESA's Larkin Page Jacobs reports, a new generation of tools is being used to try and clean up blighted neighborhoods.
If a city were a human body, then blight is a disease.
I'm telling you, blight is contagious. It's like a damn virus.
That's Aggie Bros, deputy director of the Bloomfield Garfield Corporation. Bros explains that as a neighborhood's population ages, property upkeep and tax bills can be low spending priorities for poor seniors. When they die, the property is often loaded with debt and their children don't want it, so it sits unclaimed and unmaintained. In Pittsburgh's Garfield neighborhood, more than a quarter of the parcels of land are vacant or contain vacant properties. A number of them grow thick with weeds in the summer and slowly deteriorate from freezing and thawing through the winter. One has to go back many seasons to understand the origins of blight, according to Edward Muller, a history professor at the University of Pittsburgh. He says blight is a way of describing a property's condition. But blight is also a legal term introduced in the Urban Housing Acts of 1949 and 1954.
Blight was defined by the states as a way of characterizing housing in a neighborhood. It could then, under the Urban Renewal Acts, could be cleared, taken by eminent domain, and readied for development, at which point it would then be sold to private developers to renew.
With new laws on the books after World War II, cities, states, and the federal government looked to rebuild their urban hubs.
And right here in Pittsburgh, we have one of the great examples, not unique in any way, just classic example, and that's, of course, the Lower Hill District.
But Mueller says housing experts and lawmakers failed to see that blighted neighborhoods that were raised to build the civic arena and acres of parking lots also contained social and economic networks.
Jobs in local grocery stores or cleaners or barbers or whatever the case may be, or even bars and nightclubs and things. When you clear that out, you are clearing out the social networks, the cultural networks, the familial networks.
Once an area is cleared, Mueller says the community and its networks are destroyed or set adrift and can't be replicated by new housing that goes up in its place. After development of the Lower Hill, Mueller says there was a shift away from large urban renewal efforts towards smaller projects that included communities in the planning process. That shift brought about community development corporations such as Aggie Bros' Bloomfield Garfield Corporation. 47 years after the civic arena went up, Pittsburgh has found a new tool to fight blight. Enter the land bank. Land bank legislation has been a priority of Mayor Bill Peduto's administration. In urging city council members to vote for it, Peduto wrote that under current laws, it would take the city more than 60 years to work through blighted and abandoned property. He vowed that with a land bank, it would take less than 9. Council passed the legislation in April. The land bank allows the city to quickly acquire and bundle tax-delinquent properties to sell to home developers, rather than the piecemeal and time-consuming approach neighborhood development corporations had taken. Bros says she's optimistic that it will slash the number of languishing properties.
I love it. It's a true need. It's a need. And it's not a need for any one given neighborhood. It's a need for the city of Pittsburgh. Decay doesn't stand still. It rolls.
And there may be more tools to help in the effort. Maura Kennedy packed up and moved across the state to oversee Pittsburgh's Bureau of Building Inspections. Peduto hired her in part because of the way she fought blight while working in Philadelphia. Blight can spread like a weed, Kennedy says.
But the opposite is also true. Once you start holding people accountable and forcing change, it's really exciting to see the spread of dumpsters and people painting their porches and, you know, reinvesting in their community.
Kennedy says in Philadelphia, a number of weapons are used to attack the problem. They include a blight court to address vacant and tax-delinquent properties. There's a local doors and windows ordinance that levies steep fines on property owners, hundreds of dollars per day for each non-functioning door and window. And crucially, city officials wield Pennsylvania's Act 90 of 2013, which, among other things, allows cities to attach fines to a delinquent owner's personal assets.
So you may not care about fixing it or paying that fine when it's, you know, attached to a building 40 miles away from you.
Right.
But when we're coming to your house in your suburban neighborhood and putting that sign on your door, you're going to be a lot more, responsive to our violations.
Right now, Kennedy is concerned with what she calls fixing the fundamentals, such as streamlining inspections and creating consistency in code enforcement. But she says eradicating blight isn't only about aesthetics. It's about the environment derelict properties propagate.
It could, you know, harbor criminal activities if it's open to trespass. You know, and then again, I think it has a real issue in terms of just making the neighborhood feel less safe so you aren't out in the streets.
Where that blight is. This is a house with children in it. This is one of our newly constructed for rents.
Driving around in Brose's little black car, she taps at the window pointing at the blighted properties that score the streets of Garfield. Brose reels off the names of property owners, addresses, and the stories behind each parcel like she's reciting family history. She lists the disappointments.
With the porch falling down, with overgrown weeds, it's nothing but old insul brick. It's windows are just falling apart. It's got lead paint on it. You got this one over here boarded up, and it's all graffitied. And it's
as well as the success stories of trimmed hedges, fresh paint, and new housing.
And she's a gem. Look at her place. Look at her bird thing. I mean, these folks think they died and went to heaven, you know, to have a brand new house that's affordable. We're all about affordable. I mean, people have to have dignity and pride. And see that when new ones over there, we put holes in. We're putting new ones here. We got this lot. We're not tackling this one yet. In fact,
block by block, parcel by parcel, Brose is trying to wrestle the neighborhood back from blight with the tools available to her and the city. She says the land bank will take a huge burden off the shoulders of the Bloomfield Garfield Corporation. But with more than a quarter of the properties in her neighborhood classified as blighted, Brose won't be short on work anytime soon. I'm Larkin Page Jacobs, 90.5 WESA News.
In our quest to battle blight, how can neighborhood improvements accommodate current residents and the next generation? How can revitalization be done in a way that's adaptive to changing demographics? The Design Center helps local neighborhoods create community-driven development plans. Joining us to talk about this is Chris Koch. She is interim CEO of the Design Center, a clearinghouse for architects and planners. What are the impressions, Chris, that you take away from what you just heard?
I think our impressions as the Design Center, as a nonprofit, our role is really to find ways that these sort of initiatives can be community-driven. So how do we work with the community to be bottom-up rather than top-down and find new innovative models to deal with blight and future growth? One of the things that we did to respond to this was to create a new innovative model, which was a designer-developer pilot that we did in Polish Hill. The idea behind that was to bring the developer in very early into the process. And these projects take a collaboration of many sort of leaders, community leaders, government leaders, business leaders. And so our role is to bring those people together to facilitate dialogue that allows us to look for innovative ways to effect these changes.
So if I ask you to explain how you work with communities to address the problem of blight, what it sounds like is there is a approach that involves a lot of different entities.
It does. I mean, we facilitate participatory design and planning, which means that we start with the community vision, but it takes a lot of different entities to talk about how we get to implementation. So we bring those people in early to be part of the planning process with the community so we can start to line up how is this work actually going to get accomplished. If we don't do that, it takes a lot longer until these communities see growth.
What are the models of planning that you are particularly interested in right now? And we mentioned this at the top of the show, that this is a problem, the problem of blight in older industrial cities. And even a developing industrial city like Pittsburgh 100 years ago was starting to see this problem unfold before everyone's very eyes. Obviously, the approach that might have been taken then, the approach that might have been taken 50 years later is different from the approach that's taken today. So explain these planning models and how they work.
Well, the planning model that we're most involved in, I would say, is a community-driven grassroots model. So the Design Center was actually developed and built in 1968 as a response to urban renewal to work with communities. So our goal is to go back and make sure that we're always responsive to that model, which is how does the community come to the table as a partner and drive that change? And that is not always an easy thing for any community to do, especially if it's a volunteer-based community. And so our role is using planning models that first start with a community vision.
But as far as the economic models, how much does the economics, if you get developers coming in, I mean, some people, their main concern is they want to make money. Or at least get the money that they put in out of the project. So how do you balance those concerns with making sure that people don't get pushed out of their communities?
Well, the Design Center acts as a bridge. Our goal in all of our projects is to bring design and economics into the planning process and define ways to support. We want developers in our communities, but there's anxiety that comes with development. So how do we help the communities navigate that? Everything has to be a compromise. When it's developer-driven, the community doesn't get to be part of that conversation. So it's finding a way for both groups to come to the table and work with our designers in the city of Pittsburgh to find solutions that work for everybody. There's always a win-win scenario. It's about finding that compromise and really talking through the issues. That often doesn't happen.
It's the Central Pittsburgh on 90.5 WESA. We are talking about the issue of blight in this first segment with Chris Koch. She is interim CEO of the Design Center, a clearinghouse for architects and planners. You can join the conversation by calling 412-246-2002. That's 412-246-2002. Email address essPGH@wesa.fm and on Twitter at essPGH. Follow the conversation at hashtag EPLive. What are the issues of blight that face your community, and what are the ways in which you'd like to see them dealt with? 412-246-2002 is the number to call, and what we're interested in are your concerns about what is happening in your community with regard to blight and possible solutions you may have at 412-246-2002. Chris, not everyone is as interested as you are in keeping people from being pushed out of their communities. Why is it important to you?
We have to honor the current residents that live in a neighborhood. They're what make that neighborhood what it is. And so if somebody wants to stay in their neighborhood, there should be different ways for them to stay in that neighborhood throughout the course of their life. And at the same time, there should be more mobility. If someone wants to leave their neighborhood and find a new place to live, they should be allowed to do that too. So we have to look at our communities as having an adaptive way to have more scales of use for people to live throughout their life and in different variations of their life, whether it's, as a family, as a senior, and find ways for all of those different entities to be in the community and stay if they choose.
We heard in the piece by Larkin Page Jacobs, one aspect of this problem is someone may inherit an older home. Their parents had it. The mortgage isn't paid off. There's a lot of debt. There's probably a lot of repair that needs to be done. The house may have been, for whatever reason, neglected over a period of years, and the family wants no part of it. The kids pretty much just want to walk away. How do you deal with that problem?
Well, I think that's what's so great about the development of the land bank. The idea with the land bank is that there will be a place for people to work with that entity and get their property within the land bank hands, that those of us who work in the community and private interests could turn that house back into some sort of usable space for a future family. If they choose to stay, then there's those of us who work in the community to help you reinvest and redevelop your property and maybe live there or rent it out. So I think there's a lot of different models, and the land bank is going to address all of those. But when you're talking about tangled title or absentee landlords, that was the reason the land bank was created, to help with those issues.
And how do you avoid having an area become gentrified?
That's a tough one. I think it takes all of us saying that we're not going to allow that to happen. I think it takes government and community leaders and the nonprofit leaders to look at how do we make a space for lots of different levels of income within a community and make sure that people that don't get pushed out when a market does get increased, they don't get pushed out of that community and have to find housing elsewhere. We're already seeing that in some of the communities where people are getting pushed out of the city into the suburbs. So we have to be better and be more intentional in making those spaces.
Is enough being done to make housing affordable for people, to create opportunities for people who might see an older home and say, this is kind of a nice area. I like it here. I might like to be able to move in here, but I don't know where to find the resources to, A, purchase the home, B, make the fixes to improve the home. it seems there are a lot of people who are willing to do that but just don't have the means to do it. So how does that get created?
I think one of the issues we've had in Pittsburgh is that we're still figuring out and starting to just look at the data about where those opportunities exist. We have to do a better job of informing communities and local community groups about where those opportunities are and find the people in the community that may want to either rent or purchase those buildings and take them over and rehab them. That's something I think that, you know, as planners, Todd and Rob and I work on quite a bit. And the Design Center is going to be hopefully playing more an intentional role in helping communities find those opportunities.
Chris Koch is interim CEO of the Design Center, a clearinghouse for architects and planners. We've come to time for this segment, but Chris, thank you so much for being a part of our program here
on
Essential Pittsburgh.
Thank you for having me.
Coming up, we'll continue our conversation about blight in Pittsburgh with the architects and planners themselves. It's Essential Pittsburgh on 90.5 WESA. It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. We're talking about the problem of blight in Pittsburgh and finding solutions to it. You can join the conversation at 412-246-2002. That's 412-246-2002. Email address esspgh@wesa.fm and on Twitter at esspgh. Follow the conversation at #EPLive. I'm joined now in Studio A by Rob Foffman, an architect and designer. Welcome, Rob.
Welcome.
And joining us by phone from Princeton, New Jersey is Todd Poole. He's managing principal and president of Forward Planning, a land use company that studies socioeconomic trends to decide what needs to be developed. Todd Poole, welcome to Essential Pittsburgh.
Thank you very much for having me.
And Todd, let's begin with you. How do you decide what needs to be developed? What does that process look like?
Well, we inform our clients from the beginning that markets are driven by households and people. So the first thing that we want to understand is what's happening trend-wise, not, you know, solely for that specific area that is being looked at for revitalization or redevelopment, but really need to understand what's happening regionally, because it's regions, metropolitan areas that really shape and influence markets. So we start with that process, and it's highly quantitative, but it's not exclusively quantitative. So what we're doing is we are looking at socioeconomic trends, growth in population, age groups, income levels, educational attainment, consumer expenditures, and so forth. We're also looking at real estate markets and labor markets. But we're also, as we use the term of art, is ground truthing what we see in the numbers, so that it's not simply an exercise of sitting behind a desk and looking at a computer, but we also want to speak with people who are knowledgeable in the local area, such as real estate brokers, community activists, public officials, to kind of vet what we're seeing, just to make sure we're correct in our assumptions and ultimately in the recommendations that we make.
Rob Foffman, talk about what it takes to come to a community consensus for a site being developed.
Well, of course, every neighborhood is unique and different. And so the first thing with Todd's work and the help of people like Chris is understanding the culture of the place and understanding what those demographic trends are in a neighborhood. So whether Oakland and Central Northside and Polish Hill are all different, right? And so we first have to understand what Todd is telling us about those demographic trends, not only where they are now, but where are they going to be 20 years from now? And so that we could take that back with developers and community groups and look at in terms of the types of housing we're going to build, for example, and how does that housing get built? What are the mechanics of it? Each neighborhood has a different answer to that. But what we're seeing is trends that relate to family size getting smaller, the nature of millennials coming back to the city and empty nesters coming back to the city. All those have an impact on the types of things we design and build.
412-246-2002 if you'd like to take part in the conversation with our guests, Rob Foffman and Todd Poole. We have Jill in Lawrenceville on the line. Jill, welcome to Essential Pittsburgh.
I'm sorry, it's Joe.
Joe, beg your pardon. It was on the screen as Jill, so you're Joe from now on.
Thank you. I'm just calling. It's not quite direct, but it has to do with the whole program. I'm one of those people that's not well off, and I'm a homeowner, and I'm trying to find out, is there somebody that can point me to help when you have, you know, things that keep your house from getting blighted, like you need help fixing the roof or plumbing that you've tried to fix? Are there any kind of services or people that even volunteer for people below a comfortable income?
Well, Joe, in many ways, you are the face of this conversation, and we were certainly looking to provide some answers for you. Chris Koch is still with us, so Chris is going to respond to that if you'd like. Chris?
Joe, we actually have a program at the Design Center called Design Consults, where we pair property owners with pro bono architects, landscape architects, and interior designers. For starting at a sliding scale fee of $25, you could spend 2 hours with an architect who could help you look at those issues and figure out what you need to fix. And then we have a lot of resources with nonprofit or other groups that help implement and get some of those services actually done. So if you want to give us a call, our website is designcenterpittsburghpgh.org, or call us at 412-391-4144, and we'll set you up with that.
Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
That's great. Thank you.
Thank you, Joe. Appreciate it. Hope that helps. 412-246-2002. Let's go to Peter in Mount Oliver, one of the area's great neighborhoods. Peter, welcome to Essential Pittsburgh.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. Hi, yes, I live in Mount Oliver, and as you know, it's a changing neighborhood. I guess you could say it's slightly outside of the city limits. And
yes, technically it is.
On a great street. A lot of people take really nice care of their property. However, there's a number of homes with elderly residents, one right next door to me that's slowly decaying. The neighbor's getting caught up on some of the back taxes, but plans on selling the property. I was interested in purchasing it. Was wondering what types of programs are out there for financing the purchase of a home that you may need to put considerable work and effort into to make the home a nicer place again.
This is a great question, Peter. And again, Mount Oliver is technically outside of Pittsburgh, but it is one of these areas, like a lot of the Pittsburgh neighborhoods, and you find this in other parts of the county, certainly. It is a neighborhood that has some beautiful old homes that, with a little bit of TLC, could be brought back to life. And you see those homes dotted among the ones that are cared for. And I often imagine, as I drive through those streets, what the property owners must be thinking about how much they've raised the value of their property, but they could be living next to a house that looks like it's been bombed out. So, Chris, you're nodding. You seem to know how to answer this.
Maybe. I think the issue is that, you know, there's a lot of services, both the city and the county. What I would say is I always start with the Urban Redevelopment Authority. They have a lot of programs that help with, purchasing property, rehabbing property. Pittsburgh Community Reinvestment Group is also starting a second mortgage program to help with these kind of issues. But I think if you reach out to one of those groups and start a dialogue and figure out what your options are, there are a lot of different services, and we'd be willing to help as well. We can point you in the right direction.
That's excellent.
Rob wanted to jump in.
I would add, at the smaller scale, whether you're in Polish Hill or Oakland, a lot of the community development corporations have also developed programs specifically for facade renovations, things like that.
Yeah, and I wanted to get into some of that. Peter, hopefully that helps. Thank you for calling. With the neighborhood plans for places like Polish Hill and Oakland, how much power do community groups have in the process, Todd Poole or Rob Foffman?
I'll start. They vary by neighborhood. The capacity of the neighborhood to deal with development and change varies by neighborhood. So we could take Oakland, which has large institutions and a very strong community development corporation that can provide a lot of services and ability to represent the neighborhood and create community plans that support that. Another scale might be Polish Hill, where it's an all-volunteer organization and needs assistance from the Design Center and the URA to help accomplish its visions. But in each case, they are really critical to helping that new projects as they come into a neighborhood.
Todd, you've got an interesting situation in a place like Oakland where I believe that the figure is something like in the 90 percentile of it might even be 98% of the people who – it is 98% of the people who work in Oakland do not live there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that's we get to work around the country and on projects. So we get to see this type of issue in a lot of different cities, urbanized areas where there's a concentration of employment, particularly, you know, good paying jobs such as, you know, within medical centers and universities and support services. Many of the people who are working in those facilities can't find quality housing that is affordable to them, and thus, you know, their commutes become ever and ever longer. And so that's part of the affordability equation, right? They're spending more money on commutation to get back and forth from home to work simply because the type of housing that they would like to have doesn't exist. And so we run up against that. And a lot of this is an education process with local officials, whether they be planning board or zoning board officials, certainly elected officials, as well as community groups and property owners on how to mitigate this issue. Because as I've often said, and certainly Chris and Rob have heard me say this, housing and the housing of people is very much an economic development issue. That is to say, it is inextricably linked to successful economic development, because if you don't have a sufficient quality stock of housing for people, and principally for workers who support the local economy, then ultimately and over the long term, your economy will not be competitive.
Could one of you explain the Oakland 2025 plan? Rob seems to want to jump in on that.
I'll give that a shot. We worked again with the Design Center and Oakland Planning Development with foundation funding to develop. About every 10 years, Oakland goes through a new planning process, updates their master plan. So the last one that was done in 2003 resulted in Schenley Plaza. So each time there's sort of a headline project. In this case, OPDC and the neighborhoods of Oakland, there are four major neighborhoods, said we really want to have this sort of neighborhood focused and how they impact the core and how you create a family-oriented community, for example, in South Oakland, and how you manage the student housing as that grows or gets reconfigured into the core, make it more dense, and obviously make more complete streets. We have access to BRT, biking, and things like that. So all of those pieces come together in a comprehensive plan that becomes a vision for that community.
Well, it seems, gentlemen, that you have an enormous challenge in that neighborhood, because when you go to the lower part of Oakland, below Forbes Avenue, you talk about blight. I mean, some of the student houses are, I mean, it's, for lack of a better way of describing it, it's right out of Animal House. But those students need a place to live. They need an affordable place to live, and they need to be allowed to, within reason, to conduct themselves and as college students. And yet you're trying to develop that neighborhood. So how do you balance all of that?
Well, it you have to look at what you're doing that causes that happen, that migration, for example, over to South Oakland. University of Pittsburgh increased its transit system out to South Oakland to accommodate students who are living further and further away from campus. Well, that unintentionally creates pressure on that real estate to go from single-family housing to multifamily student housing. So if we could find ways to work with the transportation, work with the university, develop employer-assisted housing programs. One thing that it was an amazing story, McGee Hospital, in 20 years ago, many of the lower employed staff worked in South Oakland and walked to work. Now most of them don't, and they live in Penn Hills, and they are required to get on a bus to get to Oakland. So that's part of that trend that we have to reverse. So if we can just make an incremental change of, say, 5-10% in where people live and work, we can begin to change the face of Oakland in terms of the quality of its neighborhoods.
Todd, what are some of the conclusions that you've come to about this?
Well, I want to agree with everything that Rob has just said, and I would add that when these changes do take effect and when we can get more people housed closer to where they work, that will mean them spending less time and money on, you know, commutation or traveling for work purposes, and give them more time and money to put back into the local economy to, you know, experience the quality of life that, you know, we all want to enjoy. And that's important. I think that's ultimately, that's what building community is about and strengthening community is about. So, like I said, I tie it back into an economic issue. And I think more and more cities, and the more successful cities around the country, obviously New York being one, San Francisco, and there's some other smaller examples, they've demonstrated that when you develop a sufficient and affordable housing stock for all strata of workers, and it's, you know, in walking distance to where they work, that those communities do quite well in all ways, socially, economically, and they really create vibrant places to live.
We are talking about the issue of blight here on Essential Pittsburgh on 90.5 WESA. And during this segment of the program, we have Rob Foffman, an architect and designer, with us in studio. Todd Poole, whom you just heard, joining us by phone from Princeton. He's managing principal and president of Forward Planning, a land use company that studies socioeconomic trends to decide what needs to be developed. And we also have our guest from segment one with us to add her insights as well, Chris Koch, interim CEO of the Design Center, a clearinghouse for architects and planners. 412-246-2002 is the number to call. You can also reach us on Twitter, and we have Mundania, I'm hoping I'm saying that name correctly, commenting on Twitter about companies like Walnut Capital. She says, quote, "They don't really seem too concerned about how the community feels and about involving the community," end quote. How much of a change or interest do you see developers starting to have in working with communities? Chris, certainly you reflected a mentality that is looking at reversing that trend. And Rob, what are your thoughts about that?
Well, a good example with Walnut Capital is that we did a plan, again, with help from Design Center and the CDCs around Bakery Square, and looked at the question of the future of the Rising Giant school site. What's the best type of housing to put there? Did the community have an opportunity to have input into that process before Walnut Capital built what they're building today?
There, right across from Google.
Right.
What used to be the old Nabisco plant.
Exactly. So that process didn't come out of the blue. That came out of a lot of back and forth discussion about the zoning, the leadership of Bill Peduto in making sure the community had a voice in that process.
Let's go to Grant in Grant is on the line or not on the line? Not on the line. But he did want to make a comment that I will relay to you, gentlemen and ladies. Rent keeps on going up. How do you fix those issues? And this just fits in with the whole equation of affordable housing.
Well, I think the answer is, of course.
Go ahead, Todd.
I'm sorry.
The reason that rent's going up, and it's going up nationally, is one, the Great Recession helped to accelerate that. So, there are a lot more people who lost their homes due to foreclosure. There are a number of people who cannot qualify for a mortgage today. And then they're just by choice. There's a growing number of folks, whether they're millennials or whether they're baby boomers, who are choosing not to purchase a home but would prefer to rent, and that's fine. But as these changes are happening, the amount of rental stock that's available, and particularly quality rental stock that's available, is insufficient, and it's just, it's simple supply demand, economics. As there's this greater demand for the existing stock, which is insufficient, rents are going to continue to go up until additional stock is brought online, and that's a problem everywhere. And and again, it's crowding out people's incomes that could be better spent on groceries, on going out to dinner, putting it back in the local economy, and elsewhere. So it's a challenge that planners and local economic development officials and community revitalization officials all need to cooperate to solve.
Well, Todd, and that listener was wondering about the idea of whether some sort of pressure would need to be brought to bear on landlords to maybe bring those or hold those rents at an affordable level, or do we need to have something here in Pittsburgh like rent control?
Let me say this. We work for developers and property owners as well as public sector entities, and it's the wrong approach to try to artificially hold rents steady or to really place that on the backs of the
property owners. The property owners are responding to a market phenomenon, right? And they have to earn a certain amount of money, and they will. So that's the wrong approach. The reason why the rents are rising is not simply because landlords are colluding and saying, hey, let's raise rents. No, the rents are rising simply because they know they can raise them because demand has grown substantially. And so the issue becomes there's probably, as I said before, insufficient stock. And part of that is because of current land use and zoning laws that are in place, whether that's in the city of Pittsburgh or certainly in surrounding communities, that there's still a lot of land use regulation that favors ownership over rental stock. And that's part of the problem as well.
And I'll let each of our studio guests have one final word here. We're actually over time for this segment. But Rob, your final thoughts.
Real quickly, I think you can use Polish Hills as a good example of a neighborhood in transition where they want affordability. They want it all, right? They should want it all. And the question is, can we work with developers to provide the supply that helps keep the cost down of different types of housing stock, whether it's rehab of older houses or new construction that's built smaller and more efficiently and more affordably?
And Chris Cope?
Yeah, I was going to echo Rob's sentiments, which, you know, I think the blight and vacant property issue is one of the biggest issues that we're not talking about is affordability is going to come out of those vacant properties. So how do we find and work with the land bank as it emerges to find ways to get those properties back into people's hands and start to, as Todd said, rebuild that stock in a community that will allow for more levels of affordability in the future?
It's been a conversation about blight, moving beyond blight, and improving communities. And we've had three guests joining in our conversation. Chris Koch, interim CEO of the Design Center, a clearinghouse for architects and planners. Rob Foffman has also been with us. He's an architect and designer. And Todd Poole, president of Forward Planning. Thanks to all of you for being a part of the conversation today on Essential Pittsburgh.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Coming up, a conversation about the business of golf with correspondent Rebecca Harris. It's Essential Pittsburgh on 90.5 WESA.